to be me, be me. And if you want to be you, be you. Cause there's a million things to do, you know that there are. You can do what you want, the opportunity's on. And if you find a new way, you can do it today. You can make it all true, and you can make it undo. You see, ah, it's easy. Ah, you only need to know. Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Cause there's a million things to be. You know that there are, 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 you know that there
Okay. Good morning. Hi. Okay, good morning. I really need your help now. I'm so nervous. Any suggestions? Thank you. Thank you. Now I'm even more nervous. Thank you. Sleep. I actually got my 7.5 hours of sleep, so I'm okay. Any other suggestions? Touch someone. Now I'm even more nervous. Yeah. Breathe. Okay. Sit up straight. Thank you. Permission to be human. Thank you. Okay. All right. I'm just going to let myself be nervous. Good. I should have brought it. You see, I forgot. Okay. So I was really nervous, you know, coming in today, preparing for today, thinking about it. And then I met Marian there, and she said to me, you know, Tal, this is my last class at Harvard. And I really did get even more nervous. So how many other people last class at Harvard? Whoa. All right. All right. So if you're next to a person for whom this is the last class at Harvard, ask them first, but after you ask them, and if they say yes, give them a hug. Okay, okay. All right. All right. Just a hug, all right? Just a All right. So, there's a lot I want to get through today, and here is where I want to start. I want you to take some time just to be quiet by yourselves. You know, one of the books that had the most impact on me was Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I actually wrote my college essay on. And it's by Robert M. Pirsig, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. And his second book is Lila. And in Lila, it's a fascinating anthropological study comparing Western culture, or I should say European culture, with American Indian culture. And he went and he actually lived with Native Americans, and he lived with them for a long time and studied them and learned a lot from them, and this is what the book is about. Highly recommended. It's called Lila. And he said that one of the most important things that he learned from them was their comfort with silence. We in our culture feel very uncomfortable when there is an absence of words, and immediately we jump in to fill it in. I know that, you know, I have that, and when I was running sections or when I had a small seminar, or even, you know, when people come over to visit or when I'm visiting people, there's a discomfort when there is silence. And what Robert M. Pirsig said was that he would sit around with the Native Americans around the bonfire for 2 hours, and not even one word would be exchanged. They would just sit there And, you know, just think once in a while, look at one another and smile. You know, look down again, look around. Perfectly comfortable, and it is. So what I want to do for the next hour and a half is what I want to do for the next just couple of minutes is just take time to be in your mind, in your thoughts, and think about, reflect back on this semester, just for, you know, 2-3 minutes, and actually write down at least 2 things that for you were personally meaningful during this semester, an idea that you heard about, something that you spoke about with your friends after class, something you heard in class, in section, something that you thought about that for you is personally meaningful. Just a couple of things. If there are more or less, write them down. If you don't want to write them down, just sit and meditate. And after that, also write down 2 commitments that you will take upon yourself, 2 habits that you want to cultivate, whether it's something from this class, could be exercise, gratitude, or something that has nothing to do with this class. 2 habits. Think that this is the first of January 2007, New Year's resolution sort of thing. 2 commitments that you want to take on with you beyond this class. So again, 2 things that are meaningful to you, that you found interesting, and then 2 commitments. And write them down if you so wish. Okay. Now, the next part is completely up to you whether you want to participate in it or not, and I mean it. What I'd like you to do now, if you feel so comfortable, is share with the person next to you or two people next to you either the things that you wrote down or other things that you found meaningful, interesting in this class, and then the other person shares, and then share with one another a commitment or two. If you don't feel comfortable with it, you can talk about the beautiful weather or pink shirts, whatever. Okay, just take a couple of more minutes. Couple of more minutes if you're not done yet. Just a couple of more minutes. Okay. All right. Just only two commit. Only two commitments, not more. All right. So here is what I'd like to do now. I want to hear a little bit from you. I know this is, one of the disadvantages of
of not teaching a seminar or a section is that we don't get to interact much, and I interacted a lot with you, with many of you, during office hours and faculty dinners and other meals. But I want to hear a little bit from you. So one thing that during this semester, just one thing that you found personally meaningful or interesting. I think this is maybe the best way to go over a lot of the things that we did this semester, because different people have different things that they took out of the course. So what we're going to do, Jessica is up there, and hi, Jessica. If anyone would like to just share one thing or a story, an anecdote relating to this course, what we'll do is you put your hand up, Jessica, or I will run to you, and just to hear from you what you have to say. So any volunteers? Okay, Vasco.
One lesson that I got from this class is just with the issue of compassion, just that I feel like sometimes we're our own worst critics and our worst enemy, and that we're very, very demanding of ourselves. And I feel like I'm very compassionate toward my friends and very demanding of myself. And over the course of the semester, I've learned just to become more compassionate toward myself, being more realistic.
Yeah, and you know, we thank you. No, it's such a critical idea, because we are so many of us are so difficult in ourselves. And you know, I don't remember whether it was the platinum rule or was it the platinum? No, I get my metals mixed. It was certainly not the golden rule, but it was one of the other metals. Do not do unto yourself what you would not have done unto others. You know, very often the golden rule is the other way around. It's so important. You know, it's a lesson that for me was also very hard to learn. So thank you. Thank you. Yes.
One of the things I've really taken away from this class is that we can be idealists, because all throughout my life, people have always told me that I, you know, can't change things and that's how things are always going to be. But deep down inside, I always believed that I could, and it was really just validating to take this class and see that, you know, the idealists are the realists in the deepest sense.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, idealism is realism, and I don't know where we lost that sense of idealism, because especially, you know, in this country, there were a lot of idealists here. And I think maybe over the last 20 years or 30 years at least, you know, that's how long I've seen it, there is more and more cynicism coming in. And I would argue that, you know, the cynicism or you know, you can call it the pessimism, is unrealistic. It really is focusing on the negatives as opposed to on the positives, and there are so many more positives. And our goal as idealists is to appreciate the positive, appreciate it in two senses. First of all, say thank you for it, and the second sense, make it appreciate, make it grow. Yeah, so being idealistic is realistic. Thank you. Jessica, anyone?
Oh. Not yet, Tom. No. You're going to share? Okay.
All right, we have someone there.
One theory that this class has affirmed for me is that emotions such as anger or sadness or frustration, which often have had this very negative connotation in my mind, are emotions that are important to experience because they're a part of the full spectrum of being human and having different emotions. And experiencing them actually helps me feel greater joy and happiness.
Right, so the idea that you know, so the idea is that all emotions are part of being human. And Khalil Gibran, I've shared, some of you may have read The Prophet, who's one of my favorite writers, a Lebanese writer, or lived where Lebanon is today, said that when we allow ourselves to experience the negative emotions, we carve out from inside our container, and that container is also our capacity for positive emotions. Whereas if we dull our negative emotions, we don't give ourselves the permission to be human, we're actually compromising on our capacity for joy. Thank you. Hi. That's two here.
Hello. I think one of the great takeaways for me was this notion of paying it forward. And I know you mentioned it once, but I'd never seen the movie, so me and my roommates, Theon and Camille, went and rented it and watched it and loved it. And I think that what I like best about that type of concept is that, you know, a lot of the things we do in class have to do with ourselves and, like, how we view ourselves and things that are very individualistic, but that is kind of more community-oriented and kind of encouraging us to do good things for other people, which I thought was really good.
Yeah, and you know, when people look at a class on happiness, they think, well, this is a very self-serving, self-oriented, you know, selfish in the negative sense of the word, kind of class. And what I hope one of the messages was in this class is that there isn't really a disconnect between the self and others. This is also related to what Vasco said earlier. When the Dalai Lama, when he heard that compassion in our culture means just compassion for others, he didn't understand where that came from. He said, compassion, you know, you're a human being too. And what he's communicating there is the connection between self and others. Two sides of the same coin, or maybe the same side of the same coin. Thank you. Yes.
I think one of the concepts that I really take to heart from this class is the concept of breaking out of your comfort zone. For example, right now, I'm not feeling very comfortable right now, and I quite frankly had no idea what I was going to say until just now. But the whole concept of taking risks, doing things anyway, despite the fact that you fear them, it's very liberating. And right now, just talking here right now is very liberating. I feel so much better about myself. Just raising my hand to say what I take away from this. So Tao, thank you. Thank you.
Tao.
Okay,
it's
I can't.
A voice from above.
Yes, I'm here.
Finally here. Faye is going to say something. So,
good morning, everybody, or afternoon. I guess something that I would like to learn about, I love to laugh and also say thank you, which is an interesting combination, but learning about how laughter and gratitude really do a positive effect on people was really nice to hear, because I've sort of always felt it and understood that to be true, but to hear that that actually is the case was really wonderful for me. So thank you.
Great. Thank you.
One thing I've learned in this class, which has been very liberating, is the ability to enjoy the here and now. Because I think it's kind of easy to get caught in rat race activities that we think are important, but we don't necessarily enjoy. So with the three-question method, I've been able to do activities that I enjoy and which are also useful. So thank you for that.
Just very quick story. My roommate and I were taking the same class, and I think one day we're working on some kind of state software set, and we've been working for a long time, and all of a sudden the computer just crashed. There goes like half of their work, and it's funny how both of us simultaneously just screamed like, "We gotta learn to cope," and then we all burst into laugh. So I mean, the story just shows. I think one takeaway for me in this class is that you know, you can run into a lot of obstacles in the future, but be positive and learn how to cope and just kind of look at the big picture is pretty important. And also just, I sometimes just a burst of laughter would definitely help to kind of lighten up situations. So thank you for the great class.
Jessica, anything? Any takers?
I'm a taker. I wanted to say thank you to all the students for being so amazing this semester and really putting their all into the course and showing up to each section really motivated and really willing to go out of their comfort zones and just be so wonderful. So thank you guys. Thanks for that. Thank you.
All right, let's take a couple more and then we'll continue.
Well, something pretty amazing or lucky happened to me because I was in the middle of interviewing for some summer jobs that I really wasn't that interested in, but I felt that would be really good for me. And then I came to this lecture on the day where you said, you know, you have to decide what you want to do, and then you have to decide what you really want to do, and then you have to decide what you really, really want to do. And I think because of that, I didn't go to the interview that I was supposed to go to, and now I'm doing a different summer job that I'm really excited about.
Everybody. So I think that the most important lesson that we learned in this class, at least for me, is the idea of taking risks and accepting failure. I came into this class being very uncomfortable with failing because, after all, this is what got us into Harvard. We're all perfectionists. We're all great. And this semester, my plans turned out to be completely different. Life took me by surprise, and I experienced some things that made me realize that, yes, it was a failure, but what I was going to do with it was ultimately my choice. And yes, I took a risk, I failed, but I came out of it with a much broader perspective of how things work, and I'm grateful for that because now, you know, you mentioned it a lot. Now I feel that my self-esteem is a lot higher than before, and I feel that nobody can stop me.
Nobody cares.
Thank you. Thea.
I think that for me, the thing that was most important about this class was the idea that you can really create your own happiness, and that doing simple things like a gratitude journal or just being a merit finder and learning to interpret things in a positive manner can actually just make you a more happy and fulfilled person. Because I feel like a lot of times we keep waiting for external circumstances to make us happy. You know, whether we get this or someone else does this or if we go there. And at some point, you have to sit down and say, if you want to be happy, you have to start now, and you have to start today, and you have to start by just changing the way that you view the world. And I think that's something that I can take with me for wherever I go and whatever I do, because it doesn't matter where I am, as long as I'm thinking the right way, I can make myself happy.
We have a taker.
Yeah, one thing I've learned from this class that I feel is really important is the idea that happiness is on a continuum, so that the question we should ask ourselves rather than how can I be happy is how can I be happier. And honestly, you know, the more, if you ask yourself how can you be happy, it's this kind of binary idea that you try to reach some sort of perfectionistic goal that you just can't reach, and you'll never be able to say, oh, I'm truly happy now. But you can always improve your life and make yourself better off and look back and say that I've made progress from where I was before. Thank you.
Am I on? Yeah. Well, thank you. So was that cheesy or what? Again, permission to be cheesy. I hope it's granted. So how do we become happier? I want to end with 1504 top 10. I too did what you did, looked over my notes, my lectures, and collected what I think are the top tips from the class. They may be ones you resonate with, many of them. I think actually most of them were mentioned here. But just to look back so that we can look forward. We emphasized a lot the importance of questions, the kind of questions that we ask. A question begins a quest. A question is a request from the universe, from yourself. And very often the questions we ask determine the kind of journey, the kind of quest that we take. The first question that we asked in the class is, how can I become happier? How can I help society become happier, have more of the ultimate currency? And the emphasis was on happier rather than on happy. Because you can really measure, I mean, am I happy or not, relative to whom? But I can certainly say that today I'm happier than I was 10 years ago, and hopefully 10 years I will be happier than now. I can certainly learn to contribute, whether it's to my students, my employees, when I work, my family members, my friends. How can I be happier? This is the first question that we talked about in the class. Also, we talked about how positive psychology, what it does, is essentially change the questions, the research questions that we ask. So remember the example of an at-risk population, where most of the questions that were asked until the positive psychological kind of thinking came onto the scene were, why are so many kids failing? And the answers that we got were accordingly, broken homes, no money, poor education, and so on. And then a different approach came onto the scene, and the question became not why are so many people failing, but those who are succeeding, what are they doing right? Why are they succeeding despite the difficulties, despite the hardship? And let's learn from them. And it's the same question that we asked about Harvard students. Not why are so many perfectionists and so many stressed, overwhelmed, but what can we learn from those who are having a wonderful time here? And not only from others, also from ourselves. What can we learn? And that was the first response paper. What can we learn from our past, from the best experiences that we've had? And how can we take the past to inspire the present and leverage for the future? And then we came to the tip of the STEM statistics approach of Maslow, where he says, let's focus on the most successful, on the best, whether it's within us or in others. Let's learn from it and apply it. The questions that we ask make all the difference. What we focus on makes all the difference. We then talked about the three-question process. What is meaningful to me? What is pleasurable to me? And what am I good at? In other words, what is purposeful for me? What is my calling? What do I enjoy doing? And what are my strengths? Answering these questions, making the list, and then looking for the overlap, because that is the zone, not only happiness, but also long-term sustainable success. Whether it's for a summer job, whether it's for a lifelong calling. And that's how we find our calling as opposed to a career, as opposed to a job. not easy, and sometimes the first 2 years or the first 5 years, we don't have as much flexibility. Many people don't have that kind of flexibility to ask these questions and then follow up on them. A single parent who has to bring food home doesn't really have the luxury that many of us have to ask these three questions and follow up on them. However, the research that we talked about when we spoke about self-concordant goals is that even if we find an activity over the weekend, whether it's spending time with our family, whether it's a hobby, that responds in the affirmative to the three questions, meaning, pleasure, and strengths. Even the 2 hours over the weekend or an hour in the evening can have a trickle effect to the rest of our life. So even if next year you have chosen to go to consulting or investment banking or law school or med school where there is a lot of pressure, don't forget to introduce the happiness boosters to your lives, because even an hour or two or three can color the entire experience. It's not all or nothing. Either I have the ideal job or life sucks. There's a lot in between. Ideally, at a later point, or maybe right out of college, for the lucky few, you can find this ideal job. But usually it takes much longer, first of all, to identify what you want, and second, to find it also in the world. But again, it's not all or nothing. We can do it and build gradually toward it. We talked a lot about beliefs, a self-fulfilling prophecy. Nathaniel Brandon, self-concept is destiny. What we believe about ourselves is very often what will actually happen. The 4-minute mile story is so powerful because what it shows is the power of the mind, that the mind doesn't like when there is inconsistency between what is inside and what is outside. It wants there to be a match, harmony between the two. And therefore, we very often, if we have negative beliefs, we bring reality to match these negative beliefs. If we have positive beliefs, we bring up reality to match these positive beliefs. The number one predictor of happy long-term relationships. What are our expectations of the other person? Do we believe in that person? And we talked about positive illusions. And I said, I agree with the positive part, but not with the illusions. Because if we expect a lot from the other person, what we're doing is we're seeing a seed. Marva Collins, when she looks at her students, is she unrealistic? Well, she's seeing a seed there. She's seeing the potential. She appreciates it. She makes it grow. Her expectations become a reality. Another key idea. This is for me a personal mantra that I repeat over and over again. Learn to fail or fail to learn. It is no coincidence that the most successful people in history are also the people who failed the most. Research by Dean Simonton shows that with scientists and with artists. We saw the biography briefly of Abraham Lincoln. The successful people are people who get up after they fall. There are no shortcuts, not with Thomas Edison, not with Babe Ruth. Everyone knows that Babe Ruth had the most home runs for many of the seasons that he played. Very few people know that he also had the most strikeouts for most of the seasons that he played. It goes hand in hand. I said to you in class earlier, I have two hopes for you. The first hope, when it comes to this, is that you will learn to reconstruct situations rather than seeing failure as a catastrophe, as a stumbling block, to look at it as a learning experience, as a stepping stone. And it is very much up to you how you interpret the reality. Remember something that I repeated over and over again. Our happiness is not contingent on our status or the state of our bank account. It's contingent on our state of mind, the way we learn to look at the world. And the second hope that I had for you was that you fail more. And I really meant it. I know that failures will hurt. I'm aware of it, and I'm aware of it from personal experiences. But this is the way to grow. This is the way to cultivate resilience over time. And as I said, it is no coincidence that the most successful people are also the people who have failed the most times. Learning to fail, putting ourselves on the line, taking risks which make us more likely to fail, is one way to raise our self-esteem, one way to raise our beliefs in ourselves. Why? Because if we see ourselves speaking in front of 800 people, even though we don't want to do it, even though we're not sure what we're going to say, putting ourselves on the line, speaking up, whether it's in section or at work next year when you go out to the big world, standing up and saying, I disagree, even though we're afraid to. What happens there is that we see ourselves from the outside, and self-perception theory kicks in. And what self-perception theory says, this is by Daryl Bem, is that when we see ourselves behaving that way, we derive conclusions about ourselves according to this behavior. So if I see myself speaking up, if I see myself taking a risk, if I see myself trying out for a play, if I see myself going out and asking someone out, even though I'm afraid, the interpretation will be, oh, this is a person with self-esteem. This is a person who believes in him or herself. And that's how we raise our beliefs over time, not by avoiding challenges, but by coping, by putting ourselves on the line. Learn to fail or fail to learn. Or fail to grow. There are no shortcuts. It's not always easy, but we need to get to our stretch zone. No need to get to the panic zone, but to the stretch zone where healthy growth takes place. This I've repeated like a broken record. And I think I'll continue repeating it for the rest of my life. A, for the benefit of hopefully students and whomever will listen, and B, for my own benefit. This has been very important for me. And I think it's a critical element of this class, even though it's not, you wouldn't find it in your normal, usual positive psychology class. But as I said, I think this class is even more about reality psychology than about positive psychology. There are two kinds of people that I mentioned that don't experience sadness or anxiety or anger or disappointment. Remember, the psychopaths and dead people. All the rest do. So if you do have these emotions, if you do happen to stumble on anxiety, perhaps when you start your work or over the summer, or fear, or you feel down, it's a good sign. You're not a psychopath and you're alive. Permission to be human. The last thing I would like you to come out of this class with is thinking, okay, I've been through positive psychology. I know these exercises. I'm doing my gratefulnesses. I'm even starting some yoga. I'm exercising 3 times a week. I'm sleeping 8 hours a night. I'm touching and being touched. And I'm not happy? What's wrong with me? There's everything right with you. You came into this class as a human being, and you're leaving as a human being. And that's a good thing. I don't think they would have allowed me to teach a class that didn't fulfill this requirement. the last thing in the world that I'd like you to come out of this class is thinking that these emotions are avoidable. Now, do they hurt? By definition, hurting hurts. When we're in the middle of hurting, would we rather do without it? Would we rather feel good? Of course. It's natural. However, also remember and try to remember when you're in the midst of it, you're alive. That's all it's saying. You're a human. Now, it would be nice if we didn't have these emotions. Maybe. It would also be nice if I could fly. But imagine leading my life and saying every day when I wake up, I go like this. And then I say, damn, I'm not flying again today. What's wrong with me? Now I need to get into the bus and go all the way. And, you know, it's such a waste of time. And, you know, I should be making more for my life than walking to class or getting on the bus. Imagine leading a life like that. No different. Just like we can't fly, just like we don't have wings attached to us like birds, because it's part of our nature, it's part of our nature to experience negative emotions as well. And nature to be commanded must be obeyed. Francis Bacon in the constrained view of human nature. Yes, it would be nice if I didn't experience anxiety, if I didn't experience sadness or depression at times, it would be nice. It would also be nice if I had wings and I could fly. And yet we accept the physical laws of nature so much more readily than we accept the psychological laws of nature. And if we learn to do it, it can take us to the next level. Because paradoxically, when I allow these emotions, as I mentioned earlier with Khalil Gibran, when I allow these emotions, paradoxically, I also open myself up for more happiness. Number five, and again, these are not in levels of importance, it's more chronological actually than anything else. Remember Jamie Pennybaker's work on journaling. People who wrote a journal for 4 days, for 20 minutes each day, about difficult experiences that they had, traumatic experiences that they had, something that they haven't perhaps told anyone else. No one else saw these journals, but these people simply wrote them. Initially experienced higher levels of anxiety because these things brought up and they aroused certain emotions, but then their anxiety levels went down and stayed lower than the base level before. They were not only happier, had more positive moods, they were also healthier relative to a control group that just wrote about random things that happened to them during the day. It may hurt to open up, but do it either with a journal or with someone you care about deeply. And not only about negative emotions. What we saw from the research of Laura King is that opening up about peak experiences has the same effects. Because if you write about a peak experience, about great things that happened to you, what you're doing, just as you're doing with negative emotions, you're synthesizing it, you're internalizing it, you're making it coherent, which is, by the way, why therapy very often works. Because we learn to tell a story, a coherent story about what happened to us. It doesn't make things go away, but it begins to make sense of things. We're more at ease, at peace with it. And it also works for positive things. And you're much more likely to experience a post-peak experience order, which is the exact opposite of post-traumatic stress disorder. A post-peak experience order, if you actually write about these peak experiences, if you actually share with people you love and people who care about you the wonderful things that happened to you or that are happening to you. This is important for everyone, and the research was done on everyone. It is especially important for the male population. And again, this is an overgeneralization, but the research shows that males generally open up less than females do. And that's why, as I've mentioned a few times before, men usually benefit more from marriage than females do. Not that women don't, but now there are the conditions for men to open up. So remember that. Opening up, not saying, and I've repeated this before, not saying wear your heart on your sleeves. No means do that. So find a safe environment. And if it's for you, it's the journal that is password protected, that's perfectly fine. But when it stays inside, it doesn't help. And in the long run, it hurts a lot. Cultivate the merit finder in you. Merit finders, as opposed to fault finders, are happier, physically and mentally healthier, and they live longer. And how do we cultivate it? By cultivating a habit of gratitude, for example. The work done by Robert Emmons on counting your blessings. We talked about it a lot. I know that many of you are keeping a gratitude journal. And the important thing about keeping a gratitude journal is not to start taking that for granted, because the gratitude journal is about not taking the positive things in our lives for granted. So how do we keep the gratitude journal fresh? It's a challenge. It's a real challenge. And the way to do it is when we sit down before going to bed, writing down those things, visualize these things. So if you write family every night, visualize what is your family, where is your family? What are the nice things that you remember about them? Make it fresh and new every day. If you write about God, what does God mean to you in your life? Not just going through the motion and taking it for granted, okay, so I wrote family, I wrote God, now I have to go to sleep. Really imagine that, really think about it. Or if it's a meal that you had during the day, reflect back to the day. What did I do? Who did I meet? Who did I see? What am I grateful for? What are the things that I can appreciate in my life? And when we appreciate something, we feel better and we make it grow. We make it appreciate. People who keep a gratitude journal, who maintain the meaning and the intention of it, are happier, healthier, or more likely to achieve their goals, are more generous toward other people, and lead an overall more fulfilling life with such a simple intervention. Why? Because it retrains our mind in a sense. It creates new channels that we go more toward the positive, because then during the day we start looking for great things, for positive things, for things that we can be grateful for later on when we reflect. A merit finder is not Pollyannish, pink glasses kind of person. Not at all. As I said, this is a class about reality psychology, first and foremost. I don't think it's healthy to just say, well, everything is great. And as I've mentioned a few times during the class, I really don't believe that things just happen for the best. Maybe you do, I don't. But what I do believe is that some people are able to make the best of things that happen. When I was rejected from a job that I applied for, or graduate schools that I applied for, I don't think it happened for the best, but I did my best to make the best of things that happen. When I was thrown out of Cambridge University, when I got injured playing squash, I don't think it happened for the best, but I did my best to make the best of things that happen. We don't have control about everything that happens in our lives, but we do have control as to how we interpret what happens, and we do have control about what we do about what happens. And this is where merit finding comes in, and this is what the power of merit finding is. Because when I fall down, I get up again. And I say, okay, what can I make of this situation? Of this lemon, of this dark cloud, of this failure? What can I make from it so that I can grow, so that I can learn? And this is the challenge. It is very difficult to enjoy ourselves if we do not simplify our lives. It is not always possible in the here and now, but at least to aim toward it. Why simplify? So that we can have more time to exercise, perhaps, to touch, to be with our loved ones, to focus on the things that we really, really want to do. I quoted Thoreau, who asked to simplify, simplify, simplify. And what Thoreau said is that life is too short to be in a hurry. He said that in the 1840s. It is even more true today. Overcomplex life. It's a real challenge, and it's difficult because on the other side of the complexity is our notion that if I want to succeed, I have to do everything. I have to belong to three organizations. I have to be on a sports team. I have to try out for 10 different things this semester because this is the only way I'll succeed. And maybe we did succeed until now doing it. But then what about the ultimate currency that very often goes away? And this is something we compromise on. So simplify. How do we do it? By sometimes saying no. Because sometimes when we say no to others, we're saying yes to ourselves. And sometimes when we say yes to things that are not the things that we really, really want to be doing to our, with our time, we're saying no to ourselves. So simplify. Quantity of activities affects the quality of our lives. And for each person, it's different. For you, it may be 20 activities is the optimum. Or for you, it may be that one main activity is the optimum. Just ask yourself the question, when was I at my happiest? Is it when I do a lot of things and juggle a lot of balls up in the air? And some people thrive on that, and other people don't. So who are you here? These are the questions to ask. Cultivate relationships, arguably the number one generator of the ultimate currency. And the way we cultivate relationships is by recognizing whether it's romantic relationships or close, intimate relationships. It's by realizing that movies end where love begins. It is not just that we find the person and then we live happily ever after. It's like saying, well, I've just found my calling. Let's say my calling in life is teaching. And then saying, that's it, I'm done. I don't need to prepare anymore for lectures. I don't need to read about it anymore. I don't need to practice. I don't need to get feedback anymore. Or you know what? I want to be an investment banker. This is my calling. And then saying, and that's enough. I'm not going to learn how to use Excel. I'm not going to learn the markets. You know what? I'm not even going to spend time reading the Wall Street Journal because I've already found my calling. This is the equivalent. I found my loved one. We're going to live happily ever after. They do in the movies, but that's when the real work begins. That's when the real work begins. And this is what will determine whether the relationship will sustain itself for a long time or not. Remember the mind-body connection. Simplify and then take time aside to exercise, take time aside to sleep, and for hugs. The wonder drugs. They really are wonder drugs. They work. And we compromise on the ultimate currency when we neglect these in our lives. And number 10, the way to happiness is to differentiate yourself. The way to long-term relationship success is to be able to differentiate yourself. to be known rather than to be validated. How do we differentiate ourselves? How do we become known rather than validated? By asking the three-question process, by asking, what do I really, really want to do with my life? And then going ahead and doing it. By being respectful and at the same time assertive. By saying no sometimes. By disagreeing with others sometimes. And learning to do it and seeing ourselves from the outside, differentiating ourselves. BEM self-perception theory. And over time, we become more and more differentiated. At the same time, it's also about recognizing the dependent self-esteem is part of our nature, to give ourselves the permission to be human. Because no one can be completely independent from others' thoughts, other beliefs, others' actions. We are social animals. Accepting this and then asking, how can I shift the pendulum and become more and more differentiated, more and more myself? Because the more ourselves we become, the happier we become, the more generous and helpful and empathic toward others we become. And life becomes so much lighter because I no longer need to prove myself to everyone. I no longer need to impress. I can express. I can simply and naturally be. Now, when I watch all the TV shows and, you know, all the great hosts and speakers, they always have their top 10. This is, in a sense, you know, the perfect 10, right? Well, I'm sorry. I have one more. Couldn't quite condense it to 10, but permission to be human. Most classes or workshops or books or seminars on these topics lead students, participants, to experience a sense of, I can, you know, can do. I'm going to introduce a change. But many people go back to their base level of happiness. We talked about how difficult change is. It's difficult, and yet it's possible. How is it possible? The number one differentiator between people who enjoy lasting change and people who don't is that people who enjoy lasting change introduce behavioral change immediately, either through the during the workshop or right after the workshop or seminar or class. So if you want to enjoy real change, introduce it right now, whether it's by exercising or by keeping a gratitude journal or by writing a gratitude letter to someone, or by putting yourselves on the line, or whatever it is for you, writing or keeping a journal about negative and positive experiences. But do it now, don't wait. This class is about practical idealism. We need more practical idealists in this world. There are many idealists. More and more, I hope, at Harvard, in the outside world. But we need them also to understand the research out there. We need them to not only have fun with what they do, but also to introduce rigor into what they do. Good intentions are not enough. And this is what I think the power of positive psychology is, the power of the social sciences in general, and the power of an academic education. This is for all of you, but especially for those people who are graduating now, who are going to all these places and are going to make the world a better place. Just remember what you've learned and remember to continue learning, to bring rigor to the idealism. Here is what Maslow perceived psychology's mandate to be. I'm not only the disinterested and impersonal seeker for pure cold truth for its own sake. I'm also very definitely interested and concerned with man's fate, with his ends and goals, and with his future. I would like to help improve him and better his prospects. I hope to help teach him how to be brotherly, cooperative, peaceful, courageous, and just. I think science is the best hope for achieving this. And of all the sciences, I consider psychology most important to this end. Indeed, I sometimes think that the world will either be saved by psychologists in the very broadest sense, or else it will not be saved at all. This is what I believe that psychologists can do for humankind. Whether professional psychologist or in the broadest sense, people who have studied or people who study human nature. Because nature to be commanded must be obeyed, and to obey it we need to understand it, both on the individual level of the man or woman, as well as societal level. And very often we think, well, what change am I going to make? One person. How am I going to make a difference? And what we talked about in the class, the pay it forward idea, is that we underestimate our capacity to affect change because we underestimate the growth of an exponential function. If we smile at three people and make their day, and they make three more different people's days, and so on and so on, after 20 iterations, we would have touched every single person in the world. And smiles and laughter, we know, is contagious. So here is something that a few of you sent me.
That is gonna make you laugh now, ready?
So it's about spreading happiness. It's about bringing about the happiness revolution, about getting people to understand that happiness is not a zero-sum game, that it's a positive-sum game, because as the Buddha said, thousands of candles can be lighted from a single candle, and the life of the candle will not be shortened. Happiness never decreases by being shared. And if more and more people understand this, then psychology can truly liberate the world. Because we understand that it's not about you having more money and me having less that is ultimately what's more important. It's not about you having land and therefore I can't have that land, which is a zero-sum game. It is about understanding the nature of the ultimate currency. It's not land, it's not money, beyond, of course, fulfilling our basic needs. It is happiness. And happiness grows by being shared, by being paid forward. And we do it by being the change that we want to see in the world. By being that change. Because to help others, we first and foremost need to help ourselves. Two sides of the same coin. How can I lead a more fulfilling life? How can I be happier? How can I differentiate myself more? Because when I do that, I'm in the best position to help others. And to help you remember this, I know that you will be going to many, many places. And oh, the places that you will go to very often will require that you fly there. So each time when you fly and you hear the message, the same message over and over again like a broken record, you will hear that if the oxygen masks come down and you have someone who needs help next to you, you need to first take care of yourself. So remember that every time you're in a plane, every time you fly, take care of yourself. Because when you take care of yourself, you're taking care of others. When you take care of yourself, that's when you can be the most generous and beautiful to others. And remember to reflect just for a minute whenever you see this or hear this, and I suspect you will hear it many times. Take a minute aside to just think, am I taking care of myself? What gift can I give myself? The gift of the present, to exercise when I reach my destination, to hug. What is it for me that will take care of me so that I can be so much more generous and so much more beautiful for other people inhabiting this planet? This class would not have been possible without the help of many people. I would like to express my deep, deep gratitude to Barry Reed in the back. I can't even begin to tell you how helpful he has been, and always give me a few more minutes for gratitudes, please. Barry Reed, how helpful he has been throughout for the two courses, always responsive. I'm grateful. Also to Megan Buckingham, who is filming this class. Thank you. It's because of her that you were able to miss some classes, to sleep in late, to get your 8 hours quota. I'd like to thank the teaching staff of this class, and I would like to first ask our head TF, Jessica Glazer, Sean Acor, and Jeff Perotti to come up to the stage. I don't think you realize what it's like to start an organization from scratch that has 1,400 employees in it. We weren't expecting the size of a class or the leadership class. We were thinking, and I would have certainly done it had I not had a choice, to limit enrollment in this class. Had it not been for these three wonderful people, this class would not have been able to be the way it is, to run so smoothly. And I just wanted to thank them in person and to have you thank them. I think they deserve a lot, so thank you. I would like to ask the teaching staff to come onto the stage, please, the other teaching fellows. Sorry to embarrass you, put you out of your comfort zone, but please come up. was walking around with Lee from the Box Center, the teaching center, and she told me she's seen all RTFs there in groups where they went to work on improving their teaching. Some of them were filmed. And she said she had never in her life at Harvard seen such an enthusiastic and committed group of teachers. We're so very lucky to have them here. So thank you again. And finally, I want to thank you. Each and every one of you is a wonder. Each and every one of you is an entire world in the making the world, your world, and our world a better place. So thank you.